Good morning. This is Neil Strauser with the CBS World News Roundup. The attempt inside is in formality, with Secretary of State Vance bringing the foreign ministers of Egypt and Israel together in a living room setting. But outside, the castle walls frown down and the security is heavy as the U.S. attempts to get Mideast negotiations going again. Marvin Kalb reports from Kent, England.
The terrorist threat that forced this meeting to move from a downtown London hotel to Leeds Castle here, located about 45 miles to the southeast of London, appears to be an active and continuing one. Additional American security has arrived, and British police, who normally make it a point of not being armed, were heavily armed this morning, many of them in flak jackets, as the foreign ministers of Israel and Egypt formally resumed direct talks under American sponsorship. Last night, after all three foreign ministers were helicoptered to this castle, surrounded by a moat connected to land by a single drawbridge, Secretary Vance met separately with Israel's Dayan and then Egypt's Kamo to work out procedures for today's opening round of talks. What procedures and how the talks are actually going, none of this is quite clear at this point. Maximum security apparently means minimal information. The hope was that Egypt and Israel would at least agree to meet again on a regular basis and narrow their vast differences over a Palestinian settlement on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In addition, both sides know a time clock is ticking. In October, their interim agreement in the Sinai expires. Marvin Kalb, CBS News, Kent.
In their absence, a Soviet court today convicted two American reporters of libeling Soviet television. Bernard Redmont has details from Moscow.
The court ordered Craig Whitney of the New York Times and Harold Piper of the Baltimore Sun to print in their newspapers or in the Soviet press within 5 days a retraction of their articles about a Soviet dissident. Both men had quoted sources close to the dissident, Sviad Gamsakhurdia, as saying they believed his film television confession had been doctored. In a surprise action, the court produced Gamsakhurdia in person, and he testified that his confession was authentic. Whitney and Piper have been ordered to pay court costs set at about $1,700 each. If they do not obey the verdict, they are subject to fines of $75 to $450. Whitney and Piper are on vacation in the United States. They had announced in advance they would not appear. They argued the allegations were factually inaccurate and legally questionable. It's not yet known whether they may face other consequences. The prosecution had asked the court to recommend that the Soviet authorities should cancel their accreditation as correspondents here. But the court did not include this in the publicly announced verdict. Bernard Redmont, CBS News, Moscow.
The New York Times' Craig Whitney told CBS News he doesn't know if the Times will print the retractions or if he will pay the fine, but said he does want to return to reporting in Moscow. They're saying this morning that the accomplishments at the economic summit in Bonn were on the moderate side, but President Carter has returned to the White House claiming satisfaction. Ed Bradley has more.
With the summit behind him and agreement from this country's major trading partners to heat up their economies, President Carter returned to the White House last night. He was greeted on the South Lawn by Vice President Mondale, who called the trip extraordinarily successful. Mr. Carter also made expected pledges to the other heads of state.
We made promises also that I intend to keep, to hold down inflation, and to meet the greatest single concern of others, and that is the excessive waste of energy in this country and the excessive imports of foreign oil.
The promises made by the president in Bonn bring him right back to his stalled energy program. To keep those promises, he needs that legislation passed by Congress. Ed Bradley, CBS News, Washington.
Congressional agreement on crude oil taxes and other measures still seems far off. But the Senate votes this afternoon on one element of Mr. Carter's energy package. Nelson Benton reports.
Parliamentary posturing delayed the action while President Carter was attending the economic summit in Bonn. But today, the Senate is likely to approve one part of the comprehensive Carter energy plan and send it to the House. A vote is scheduled this afternoon on the coal conversion package approved by House and Senate conferees. It sets down rules that would encourage, and in some cases compel, oil and gas burning industries and utilities to switch to alternate fuels. In most cases, the logical alternate is coal, thus the term coal conversion. Backers of the bill say it would reduce oil imports as much as 1 million barrels a day by 1985. Skeptics say savings would be far less. In any event, it is the part of the Carter plan most likely to win approval in both houses of Congress. After Senate approval, the coal conversion measure goes to the House, where the leadership is expected to postpone action until other parts of the Carter energy package clear the Senate. Nelson Benton, CBS News at the U.S. Senate.
Supporters of the Equal Rights Amendment face a crucial vote today in the House Judiciary Committee. They are asking for extension of the 7-year period allowed for ratification of the amendment by the states. They wanted another 7 years, but believe they can win a narrow vote for a 3- or 4-year extension. The Equal Rights Amendment would add a single sentence to the Constitution, ensuring that no person's right to equal opportunity under the law be denied or abridged on the basis of sex. 35 of the required 38 states have approved it, but supporters concede there's no chance to win ratification by 3 more states before the current ratification deadline in March of 1979. Striking firemen in Louisville, Kentucky voted overwhelmingly early this morning to accept a new contract and now are returning to duty. Bob Faw has the story.
The bitter dispute was settled after 12 hours of secret on and off bargaining. The city, which said it had no extra money, found some, and in return for increased productivity, gave the 600 firefighters an average pay increase of about $1,600. Union Acting President Granville Ennis was pleased, but admitted the 4-day strike had been painful.
There are no winners. There's never a winner in a strike. The city lost, the citizens lost, and we lose. There are no winners, but sometimes it's necessary to show the plight to the people who can help you.
The strike shut down 2/3 of the town's fire stations, leaving 350,000 residents with fire protection from only 200 untrained Kentucky National Guardsmen and 27 exhausted fire department supervisors, some working 4 straight days without sleep. The makeshift department coped, largely because no major fires were reported. Now, firefighters are returning to work, with normal service expected to resume by mid-morning. Bob Faw, CBS News, Louisville, Kentucky.
Residents of Philadelphia still are driving their own trash to refuse dumps around the city as the strike of some 20,000 city employees in Philadelphia enters its 5th day. The city may decide today whether to seek contempt actions to force prison guards and other employees termed essential to return to work. In Washington, talks between the Postal Service and the postal unions continued late into the night, but there appears no agreement yet on any of the major issues. The present contract expires on Thursday. In New York, a second day of testimony is scheduled in the suit brought by a woman who wanted to become the mother of a test tube baby and was denied when hospital officials terminated the experiment. Steve Young reports.
Doris Delzio returns to the stand this morning, her lawyer seeking to lay the groundwork for her claim that she has suffered physical and emotional pain that may be with her the rest of her life because the attempted test tube conception of her baby was interrupted in 1973. Her lawyer, in opening arguments, described the technique pioneered by gynecologist researcher Landrum Shettles as nothing more than a plumbing bypass. The lawyers representing the 3 defendants attacked Shettle's competence. The evidence will show, said the lawyer representing Presbyterian Hospital, that Dr. Shettles and gynecologist William Sweeney were in vain pursuit of glory. Dangerous and untested were words chosen by the lawyer representing Shettles' former boss at the hospital, Raymond Vanderveel. The lawyer representing Columbia University said that compared with the procedures used in England and the case of a woman soon expected to deliver the world's first authenticated test tube baby, Landrum Shettles used a Model T technique, certain to fail and dangerous as well. Steve Young, CBS News, New York.
The heat wave in the southwestern United States continues unabated, with temperatures topping 100 degrees predicted today from southeastern California to eastern Texas and north into Kansas. That means the 17th straight day of over 100 in Dallas, Texas, and the National Weather Service says there is no relief in sight. Hot winds from Mexico are blocking any southerly flow of cooler air. In Dallas yesterday, it was 103 degrees. At least 21 deaths in that area have been blamed on the heat.